Been getting a lot of that lately here across Wisconsin. Rain and weather and tornadoes, and we're going to be talking about some of that with our, I said our weather guys earlier, but it's really our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, with us today. Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. He's with us to talk about weather and climate, and we're going to zero in a little on tornadoes just to start things off. But we can also talk about the South Pole ozone hole, the fall weather outlook, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments or maybe your weather experiences. 1-800-642-1234, or email us your question. And if you got a great weather photo, we always love to see weather photos and sometimes questions relating to them. Just go to ideas at WPR.org, and we'll post those pictures up, ideas at WPR.org. Steve Ackerman, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here, although a little sad not to have John. He's off at a conference in Europe. Usually right. The Europeans come to the U.S. for this conference. I think it's on winter storms, but this year the U.S. decided to go over there.
So. All right, so there he is.
Maybe that's why he didn't call in.
He'll give us an update next month.
Yeah, and we'll save all the hard questions for him to take next month.
Well, there was at least one confirmed tornado that touched down in western Wisconsin last Tuesday night, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was a pretty strong one. And the EF3 tornado, yes. Which is, you know, the highest is a 5. So
yeah.
It's what's called a strong tornado, little level buildings. Fortunately, nobody was hurt this year, or this one this year at all. We've had 23 is the average, and this year we've had 25 tornadoes for 2019 so far, and 11 of them occurred in July this year. So it's kind of interesting how they, you know, when I look at last year and the year before that, last year most of the tornadoes occurred in August, and the year before that most of them occurred in June. So they kind of come in clumps.
Yeah.
Like 17 of the 25 that we've had occurred between July 19th and July 18th and July 20th. Yeah, so they all come
days,
in, right? When you get an outbreak, you get a bunch of them. And every now and then you get a storm that just drops one.
And what's the criteria for a tornado to develop?
So we need a couple of important ingredients, and then whether or not it will form is another question. But we need wind shear, so we need the wind to change with height, both direction and speed, and that kind of sets the environment up in a rotational kind of way. And then we need warm, moist air near the ground and cooler air up above, so that when we get some mechanism to force it, like solar heating of the ground and the lower level air, once that air starts to move vertically, it becomes unstable and then just takes off by itself and doesn't need to be have any kind of physical force trying to push it up.
And so a class 3, how are the classifications sort of set up?
So the classification goes from a EF0, which stands for an enhanced Fujita scale. The scale was first developed many years ago by a fellow named Fujita, as you might imagine. And what it's based on is the damage that it does. So you can't classify it until you go and assess the damage. And so, you know, an EF0 will, take tree limbs off and, you know, take the tops off of the trees. And an EF5, which is the maximum, will just level everything. And so after that, they go back and look at the damage and then classify it based on the damage. But an EF3, 4, and 5 are the ones that are thought to be pretty severe and destructive.
Yeah, and of course the 5 is...
And the 5 is, yeah, total destruction. It basically destroys anything.
It just takes everything it hits. And we've had some 5s.
We've had some 5s, not very many in our state. Most of what we get in our states are zeros and 1s, sort of the weak ones. The 5s are usually in the tornado alley, the Oklahoma, Kansas areas.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the last time we might have even had a 5.
I could not remember. I'll have to save that one for John. But, I mean, even the big one in Barnfield.
Barnevelde, yeah.
Barnevelde. I don't even think it was a 5. I think that was a 4, if I remember right.
It was
and that was pretty destructive as well. Right,
so. Oh, my gosh. That's for sure. So you collect – how are data collected on this then? I mean
– they send out spotters. So physically, somebody from the National Weather Service has to go out and inspect the damage. Somebody who's trained, obviously, to do that.
And they're not out there running. Are they running around after the tornadoes?
After the tornado, yep.
But not during?
Generally not during. Let's hope not. but
there are a lot of people.
A lot of people do it, and some of the National Weather Service people go out as well. You really got to know what you're doing, and you got to really understand what storms are, because if you don't, you could find yourself in the path of a tornado by accident.
Yeah, I was thinking back. There was a book written about a guy who was very famous tornado hunter, and he took a wrong turn, I think.
And just found himself in a bad spot.
Yep. He and his son and another person all perished.
Yeah, that was about 3-4 years ago, I think.
Yeah, 3-4 years ago now. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, chasing is a serious thing. That's why I never do it. I'm just like,
Let's go in after the fact.
I'll go in after the fact and, watch all the trees broken off. But
Oh, man. Steve Ackerman, our guest, talking weather and climate with him. Questions for him, give a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Has there ever been any – well, there probably is no way you can ever stop one from – starting.
No, and that, that's the key about these weather phenomena. We really don't understand we don't really appreciate how much energy it takes to get a storm going. And so trying to stop a thunderstorm, you'd have to try and do it early in its stages, which means you would have to know where it is actually going to pinpoint where it's going to form. And we just can't do that. It's too difficult.
You think we'll ever be able to do it?
I don't think so. I think we're always getting the area where we may get enhanced storms develop. We're getting that smaller and smaller as we get better and better observations from radars and from satellites and other networks. But I don't think we'll ever be able to pinpoint it. It's just a little too there's a little randomness to it, I think, that's hard to pick up.
Well, let's expand our conversation a little bit here. And one of the things I mentioned at the start of the show was this ozone hole over Antarctica. Why is it important?
So, yeah, this was something where maybe we can look and see how human impact could actually modify something. So the ozone hole occurs over Antarctica. It really develops in this time of year, which is our fall, their spring. It's really due to molecules that we as humans emit, like CFCs. We particularly did that back in the 70s and 80s in aerosol spray cans. CFCs, these chlorofluorocarbons, are very stable. And so they find their way to diffuse up into the stratosphere 18, 19 miles above the surface where the ozone is. And then there are reactions that can separate out the chlorine molecules. And then the chlorine molecules hook up with ozones and then destroy the ozone and in the process keep themselves around. And so they can destroy multiple O3 molecules. In Antarctica, what happens is in the wintertime, it gets really, really cold because we develop a vortex, an upper-level jet stream that isolates the air and allows it to get really cold and forms these polar stratospheric clouds. And then on the surface of those clouds, these CFCs can get deposited, and then the chlorine, when the sun comes up and those clouds begin to melt away, that chlorine gets freed up and then can do destruction of the ozone. And so around this time of year, in September in particular, you see a real reduction in the amount of ozone around Antarctica. And it's primarily due to these human chemicals that we would put in refrigerators and aerosol cans as well.
That's been getting better.
It's been getting better because once we realized the science of the problem, nations across the world got together and came up with the Montreal Protocol, which would, over time, eliminate the use of these CFCs. And the amount of CFCs has been significantly reduced. And now we're seeing the positive impact on that, in that the ozone hole over the last few years has been getting smaller and not as deep. So we're not as destroying as much ozone.
Let's take a call here. Jeff in Kenosha, it's your turn. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, great show. I love this show. I was just wondering if the global warming and the melting of all the ice is creating more liquid water to be evaporated and then dumped on us as rain, and if this is partially an explanation for our wet spring summer.
It contributes in the following way. As the atmosphere warms up in general, it has a capability to, as we like to phrase it, hold more water. And so there's more water vapor in the atmosphere. So if you have more water vapor, you can have more rain. And so that's one of the contributions. As you melt the ice sheets that are in both the North and South Pole, you do two things. You put some of the water into the atmosphere, and again, because it's warmer, more of it will stay around. And the other is you put it into the ocean, which then also helps to change the ocean circulations. As you change the ice sheet, I think the bigger effect, rather than putting more water vapor into the atmosphere, is that it looks like it changes the weather patterns that we're experiencing. And that allows issues with regard to storm development and where those storms occur. So I think that's more of a role than putting more water vapor into the atmosphere.
And we can talk some more about that, Jeff, in just a minute or two. We are talking today with Steve Ackerman, our weather guy, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. We certainly look forward to hearing from you at 1-800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with Steve Ackerman. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we take a look at climate and weather now on the show. Larry Mueller here. Steve Ackerman with me, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Comes by once a month, usually with John Martin, but John's off in Europe today for something else. And so Steve's perfectly happy to take your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jim in East Troy has something relating to an earlier call or conversation we were having. So let's go there. Hi, Jim.
What we said.
Good afternoon, gents. I really appreciate the weather, guys. This is like the best show of the month.
Thanks. It's a lot better with John and me.
EF5 was the Oakfield tornado in 1996.
Yeah. Yep.
And so I'm in East Troy, and I remember looking to the north and seeing the thunderhead that produced that thing. And I'm 80 miles away, and it was huge. I mean, it was up at flight height. And so I was at Farm Technology Days the next year, and I talked to a farmer from up north, and he was like 80 miles away. And he said the same thing. It's like, I looked to the south and I saw that cloud, and it was spectacular. So I just wanted to share that experience.
Yeah, thanks. The Oakfield was an EF5 tornado. We were just wondering if we had any. And also Bonneville was also an EF5. Tornado. So I had that one wrong. But yeah, you know what's interesting, at least I found interesting, is that, when we've been on a lake, for example, and you look on the horizon and you'll see this huge thunderstorm, right? And then you'll wonder, wow, looks like it's coming our way. And then you bring up a radar app that shows you where the precipitation is. And yeah, they're 80 to 100 miles away sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's because they're so tall. They get up 10 miles high.
It's amazing. And the Barneveld was 1984.
84, that's right.
So 12 years in between E5 tornadoes in the state.
Yeah. So that would make 96 if we went with that, which would not be a good way to forecast.
No, it would not be a good way to forecast it. Jim, thanks a lot. Appreciate it very much. Dave in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I read somewhere that one of the important climate prediction bodies had said something that to the effect that wet places would get wetter, dry places would get drier, and as a result of evaporation and rain. And I wonder, I know that's an oversimplification, but is that generally true? It looks like it is to me.
Yeah, it actually is pretty true. And they've looked at that from a couple of ways. One is from numerical modeling, which is kind of the laboratory of which atmospheric scientists work. And the other is they collected data in wet regions over a long time period, 30 years or more, and in dry areas, and then look at what the trend is for the areas that are wet, which means a lot of rain, and those of which are dry. And, yeah, that's what they're seeing. Wetter places are getting wetter. They're getting more rain. And that rain is coming in fewer events, which is even more important because that means it's coming down heavier. And then the drier areas are having longer dry spells. And that's sort of consistent with the what you might expect from dynamics. So to get rain or to get dry areas, you either need lifting motions to form the clouds in the rain or sinking motions, which dries out the atmosphere. And those are driven by large-scale patterns. And so what we're seeing is an intensification of that rather than a major shifting from one latitude to another, let's say.
Really interesting. Thank you very much, Dave, for calling. Jim in Wanakee, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for the nice program. I have a couple of questions about the effect of the rainforest. You know, of course, recently there's been that burning down in Brazil of the rainforest, and it's having a devastating effect on the climate. I'm wondering, as a layman, if you could explain to me just how that, you know, it's said to be the lungs of the world down there in the rainforest. Now, I understand the concept that plants absorb carbon dioxide, I believe, and then they give off oxygen. Is that what they mean by the lungs of the world? Or could you expand on that? And then the other thing is that if this burning continues over time, how would that affect the United States and particularly Wisconsin, even remotely?
So, yeah, to the first questions, I think that's what they're referring to when they talk about the lungs of the world, that the Amazon forest, the rainforest, they have a lot of plants, a lot of vegetation, so they're taking in a lot of carbon dioxide. And then, yeah, the byproduct of photosynthesis is then oxygen, which comes in to the atmosphere. And of course, once you take those forests down, whether you're clear cutting or burning them, and then you're replacing them with other vegetation on the ground, they're just not going to process that much carbon dioxide and thus that much oxygen. Of course, it doesn't mean we're going to run out of oxygen. We talk a lot about oxygen recently, but with there's plenty of oxygen in the atmosphere. And then how does it affect, again, global weather patterns and thus Wisconsin? I'm not sure what the direct impact is on Wisconsin. What I do know is that people go in and in the weather models, the simulations of climate, we can go in and remove things. So we could go in and remove all the weather, all the rainforest in the Amazon, let's say, and replace it with prairie land. And what that does is changes exchanges between the land and the surface. The land and the atmosphere up above, and then that changes overall weather patterns. But I don't know how that impacts us up in Wisconsin directly.
Yeah.
What would that mean?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Jim, thanks. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or email us. I haven't had a photo yet. I'm surprised that you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. If you've got a cool weather photo, we always like to see them. And maybe a question relating to the photo as well. Phil in Lake Geneva, we'll go to you next. Hi, Phil.
Hi, you guys. I have more of a comment and see if you'll commiserate with me. We're about 5.5 miles south of Lake Geneva, and in the last 27 days, we've had 19.8 inches of rain wanted to ask your expert if he thinks I've got a record or if that's a normal amount.
Wow.
Well, it's not normal, but I don't think it's a record. You know, even up here in Madison, I think we're like 7 inches above normal in terms of precipitation at this point. And so I certainly commiserate with you because, and I'm sure many farmers will as well.
Yes.
Because it has a real impact in them getting their seeds in late in the season. And now the soil, I think, is still wet in many areas, which makes it really hard to harvest.
Yeah, so there you go. Thank you very much for calling, Phil. James in Reedsburg, on to you. Hi, James.
Good morning.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Hey, you know, back in ninth grade when I was in high school, I had meteorology and oceanography class. And the two teachers were, like, fresh out of college. And they had mentioned that our Earth at that point, 40 years ago, was at a tilt of 23 and a third. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that when that big earthquake hit India, it actually moved it more. Now, does this tilt of the Earth have effect on our weather? I would think so.
So it does. It does, but in more of an indirect way. So the tilt of the Earth is about 23 and a half degrees. It varies a little bit and it wobbles around, but the real big changes occur on hundreds of tens of thousands of years. It affects it in that it sets the seasonal energy balance of the planet. And so what that does is it changes the global circulation patterns, and thus that then impacts our weather. So when we're tilted away from the sun, which occurs in the wintertime, that typically brings weather associated with mid-latitude cyclones, you know, like the winter storms we get. And in the summer, when we're pointed towards the sun, then we typically get thunderstorms. So it kind of sets the environment up for the type of weather, but any particular weather forecast on any particular day for the next day or the next couple of days won't account for the tilt of the Earth other than that climatological setup.
You mentioning weather reminded me, or winter reminded me of the photo on the front page of the Wisconsin State Journal this morning, which was a heavy snowfall that fell out west.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. And that cooler weather is coming towards us.
That's right.
They had a big storm.
They had a big storm, which is this time of the year. Would be unusual, even out there, wouldn't it?
It is pretty unusual, pretty early. I'm sure a lot of the ski slopes will be happy because maybe they'll open up by Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
If it can stay around.
So Earth Tilt with James. Thank you so much. Ted in Madison has something else for us. Hi, Ted.
Hello. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yes. My question is, I'm like 69 years old, and I've noticed that our rivers are shrinking. You know, when they used to be always cresting the bank, now that they're like drops, like 15, 20 feet. But if the sea level is rising, why is our rivers dropping?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Sea level, so what the rivers are doing is going to be independent of what the coastline ocean levels are doing, because the rivers are going to be fresh water, so they're really going to be driven by precipitation that's falling on land. So whether it's rising or lowering is going to be a function of how much it's raining. And the other thing is then what kind of control is going on? Are they controlling it at dams, for example? But if we just put the dam situation aside and look at precipitation, you know, what we're seeing now is similar amounts of rain are coming in less frequent events. And so I think what we would end up seeing is that the water level will be lower most of the time when it isn't raining, when we have those dry spells. And then when we get that heavy rain, you'd see it rise up. So whether or not it averages out is an interesting question.
It is. And I can tell you, Ted, driving from Madison to Milwaukee area just over the weekend, the rivers that we drove over were all very high.
Because we had a lot of rain in the last couple of days.
We had a lot of rain, and so they were high. Interesting question, though. Thanks.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Mark in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi. Thanks for the opportunity. I got a question in fluid dynamics. I live on the shores of Green Bay, and we have things called seiches. It's kind of like a tide, but it's pressure-driven, and it can vary 10 inches up to as much as 30, 36 inches. And I'm trying to figure out how that water exchange actually takes place. You know, like when you have a wave coming in, it's just vertical motion. But if you have 30 inches of water coming in, is that just laminar flow on the surface, or is the whole body of water being changed over?
I think it's the whole body of water is being changed over. And the way to think of it is, one way to get these seiches is you have a strong wind coming from the same direction over a long period of time. And that physically pushes the water over to one side of the lake, the downwind side of the lake. And then once that wind weakens up, then the whole thing sloshes back.
Interesting. Thanks, Mark. Yeah. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Jim called to say that the University of Iowa has predicted 50 days of 90-plus degree weather in Des Moines. Do you know what we're predicting for Madison? He must be calling for
future,
Madison.
Yeah, you know, what I've heard is that, you know, by 2050, our weather is going to be like the weather Missouri has, right? So one way to guess that would be to go look up how many 90-degree days Missouri has. And I'm going to guess it's quite a few.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
But 50 days, that's 2 months, right? That's almost 2 months of 90-degree
weather. Yeah, that's a lot. That is a lot.
I hope we don't get that.
Kate emailed with a story. She saw an incoming windy storm and what looked like a sideways tornado. It looked like smoke from a smokestack almost. She watched it. And it didn't dissipate or move. It stayed in one spot. And wondering if there's a name for that.
It sounds like what we would call a roll cloud. And that is usually associated with a thunderstorm, which sounds like if it's a windy storm this time of year, that's probably what it's associated with. And a lot of times it'll sit along the gust front, and it'll just sit on top of the storm away from where the updrafts and the precipitations are. And if it's far away, it won't... if the storm is far away, it may not look like it's moving. But if the storm is close by, then you should see move. But if she's not, then it may be just a different kind of odd kind of cloud system develop.
Yeah, interesting. Well, it's been officially fall for a week, and today it's going to be 80 degrees in Madison.
That's crazy.
Yeah. What's up with that?
You know, it's the weather. Right, it moves around. We've seen this in the fall, in particular, where you get really beautiful weather as a frontal system is coming towards us, and we're in the warm sector, so we get nice warm air, and then the cold front moves in, and we'll drop down to 40 degrees. So it's just the kind of weather we get in the fall time.
Well, and it's, you know, tomorrow it's going to be 25 degrees cooler or something like
right,
that.
Right, yeah. And that's the cold front going by. So it's just that this is.
We
this
won't
is
be
what
getting any snow, though.
We hopefully like don't be west. Getting any snow. All right, yeah. John's out of town, so hopefully we won't get any.
Kurt in Potosi, we'll go to you now. Hi, Kurt.
Yes. Hello. Thank you, Larry. I have a question. I received. Wisconsin Energy Cooperative's news for October 2019, and there's an article titled A Heated Debate, and then it's quite long. Well, it's a three-page article, and the end of it says the University of Alabama Huntsville identified global warming trend works out to 1.3 degrees per century. I would like to know if that would be an accurate estimate from Mr. Ackerman's opinion.
Yeah, I've heard it being around over the last century, 1.3 or 1.5 degrees. And it's really important to think about, as you said, what are we talking about in terms of warming? And so you said it's global warming. And so is 1.5 degrees a lot for a global warming? Yes, because it's a huge amount of atmosphere that you warm up. On a more local scale, you know, if you were to tell me that, you know, right now it's 80 degrees outside and, you know, an hour and a half, it's going to be 81.5. I'm not really concerned about that because it's localized. And so 1.5 degree local change is really not that much energy. But when you're talking about doing it over the entire atmosphere, that's a huge amount of energy to raise it, that kind of temperature change.
So it's not, you can't poo-poo.
You can't poo-poo. No, it doesn't sound like a lot because, you know, if we live on the weather scale, it's not that a lot. But when you live on the global scale and you consider the entire atmosphere, it's a lot of energy.
And it's going to make lots of changes.
And it's going to make lots of changes, particularly if it continues on this course, which it certainly looks like is going to be the situation.
Thank you, Kurt. Tom in Appleton. Hi.
Hi. Hey, thanks. I just wanted to ask the guests, I'm quite the weather geek, and I'm always watching the maps and stuff. And when a storm system moves through our area with its low pressure area, usually a little to the north and some front dangling down, very often it seems like even days after that main thrust has moved on to the east, there's still a little gyre spinning around up above roughly Lake Superior or northeastern Minnesota. Is that just my imagination? It seems like then there'll be spits of rain maybe further to the north. And
that's a really good
point. I just see it a lot. I just wondered if there's anything to that.
Do you see it as a seasonal dependence?
I wouldn't especially say so. And I stress semi-permanent because obviously our high pressure systems
will eventually move it out
from that direction too.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, I haven't.
It's stubborn.
Yeah, we'll have to take a look at that. I mean, I've certainly seen circulations develop, but not necessarily on a regular scale. I could see it, you know, maybe happening in the springtime when you have really big temperature gradients between Lake Superior and the land as it begins to warm up, or even in the fall. But I don't know. That's something for us. We'll take a look at that. I don't really watch the weather up there very much, but I should because I think Lake Superior is a fascinating area.
Research on that and report next time. We had Rodney sent a picture. I don't know if you can see it. It looks like a cloud, like three or four.
Yeah, you're getting these undulating rolls of cloud connected to another alto cumulus type regime. So they're called altocumulus undulatus, I think, where you get this ropey feeling. And maybe that's what a previous caller might have seen when she talked about having seen those roll clouds that didn't move.
And because if they were black, they would look move. Like a, yeah. And yeah. They can be black, too, can't they?
They can be black if they get really thick.
Yeah, if they get really thick. Well, we had the Dorian map and the Sharpie incident.
Oh, right.
Does this affect or reflect on the weather agencies themselves?
No, I think the weather agencies did the right thing. And this was, you know, we have these cone of uncertainties when they're forecasting hurricanes, where they're going to go. One way to do forecasting is to run multiple models and then look at the composite models and these in terms of where the hurricane is going to go and what its intensity is. And those cone models represent the uncertainty based on all these different model runs of where the center of the storm is going to go. And so they're important for weather but agencies that are going to do evacuations. I mean, that's where they really got to pay attention to it. And so if you start talking about states that are outside that cone, then they start getting worried about what they need to do with their evacuation. And the Alabama National Weather Service, once there was an indication when President Trump said it's going to hit Alabama, there was a lot of calls that were coming in about what do we do? How do we prepare? And it was clear that the forecast at the time was that it was not going to go anywhere near Alabama. So that National Weather Service office, I think, did the right thing by saying, no, don't worry about it. That's not the situation that we're currently dealing with.
And on that note, we are out of time, Steve. Great to have you with us.
It was great to come and learn. And now we will remember the E2E5 tornadoes that Wisconsin has experienced.
Steve Ackerman, we'll be back on October 28th, as a matter of fact. That's the last Monday of October. He always comes by the last Monday of the month. John Martin will probably be joining him.
He
should be back from Europe in a month.
Hopefully.
You would hope so. Tomorrow we'll look at how sports can help teach history and a new book commemorating the 100-year anniversary of the Green Bay Packers. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.